Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, today we've got a phenomenal episode. I'm super excited. We've got Murtaza Haider back. By popular demand, actually.
You know what? Well, I feel like there's been demand for Murtaza since he came on probably 2 years ago.
About that, yeah.
But he's a busy guy. Tough guy to get. But so glad to have Murtaza Haider back on because this is a conversation that does not disappoint.
He knows so much about, like, so first
everything.
Of all, Exactly. I feel like Murtaza, like, he knows a ton about real estate. He's an engineer. He is obviously thinking about the economy and the Canadian economy all the time. He's basically, you know, he says he's not an economist in the episode, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to classify him as an economist, whether he likes it or not. But he
transportation expert.
About. Yeah, he's a phenomenal guy. But he actually is a professor at the Ted Rogers School of Management at Ryerson University. He's also the director of a consulting firm called Regionomics Inc. And he's, of course, the co-author of the Haider Moranis Bulletin in the Financial Post.
Yeah, yeah. Wears many hats and can basically speak about anything. I feel like we should have him back and just have random questions that he can explain.
I remember
explain to us and give smart views on.
Well, that's the thing. And he has a way of explaining things in like the most simplest form, which is a skill set. I remember actually in high school, a teacher had asked me to explain, and this was actually an exercise, but explain breathing to a Martian was the question.
Oh, interesting.
And
how'd that go?
Yeah,
I failed.
Failed miserably. The course, then the school. Then I got kicked out of school. No. No.
Not only did I not pass that class,
yeah. I spiraled. It ended my academic career. No, it was, but he's the type of guy that could explain anything to anyone in very, very simple forms. You're really going to enjoy this conversation with Murtaza.
Very thoughtful guy for sure. Before we get to Murtaza Haider, we got a couple things to take care of.
Yes.
One is the elephant in the room.
Right.
Which is that Michael Jordan documentary on Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. The Last Dance. I can't believe it. And it must be, I mean, it's popular on Netflix. It's popular in our network of people. We've been talking about it a lot. We've never talked about it on the show. But it must be like everybody must be watching this.
You said you walked by. Well, two funny things, right? A mutual friend of ours has now bought a basketball,
and he's like,
like an out of shape 5'4" guy,
and he's like incapable of being a point guard.
He's dribbling down in the park. But but you also walked by near your house the courts. And not only was there pickup games going on that usually are not happening, but they're also listening to 90s hip hop.
Well, no, this is the thing. So we were walking down Union by the basketball courts. It was packed, like a standing room only. Bunch of guys, some of them good, some of them not
clearly
so good.
Not playing basketball all the time.
Exactly. And I was like, what? Is that Mace? And turns out it was Big Pun. But anyways, we were watching the basketball, and there were some guys that definitely play, but there was a lot of guys that just watched that Jordan documentary, and now they're like, is there still hope?
But no. it's an incredible documentary.
It is.
It's funny. I'm not even a basketball fan, but this this documentary, there's so many interesting parts.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's also the way that they actually break it down time wise. You know, they're moving all over the place from the 80s to the late 90s, and it's beautifully done. I've been telling everybody, if you haven't watched it, you got to watch it. It's phenomenal.
Well, I mean, Jordan cries. I didn't realize his dad got murdered. That's one thing.
Maybe spoiler alert.
Well, happened in 94.
Yeah. But I actually, it's made me kind of long for the simplicity of the 90s in this kind of weird way, because I've always thought of the 90s
as when like suit pants were bigger.
Well, Jordan's parachute suit, eh? Like, that actually makes me think that Eurostyle might be going the way of the dodo bird. Like, we're bringing back the big suits. Yeah. I hope that's post-COVID.
Post-COVID suits, yeah.
I hope that's actually
parachute
the case.
Suits.
Yeah. No, I didn't gain any weight. My suits just got bigger.
But I mean, one thing you say, simpler time, like we were talking about his security detail.
Right.
And they're sitting in a room waiting for before a practice or before a game, and they're all throwing a coin to see who can get it closer to the wall. Like,
right.
It's like they're so competitive, or he's so competitive. He's always in a competition. But
that would be a game in the 90s.
That's a pre-cell phone game.
Yeah. That's something that you would do.
Like, how do we kill a half hour here?
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And I think that's the thing, is you kind of – a friend of mine said that the other day, he had said that it's crazy that he's got a young child, and he's like, it's crazy that just with the way Netflix is and everything else, my kid will never know that feeling of like sprinting into the living room because you know that it's coming back on after a commercial.
Yeah.
You know,
like you're going to miss part of the show.
You're going to miss part of the show. And all these different things that we grew up with that were commonplace. And that definitely made me long for a simpler time, for sure.
I feel like if you haven't watched it yet, I feel like everybody's watching it, but it's definitely worth watching.
Do yourself a favor.
Kind of incredible. One of the last thing about it, but how he makes up
stories. Welcome back.
How he makes
to the Jordan podcast.
But how he makes up stories, how he fires himself up during competition. It's like I don't even want to spoil that part, but it's incredible. Man, talk about drive. Anyway, one other thing before we get going here. Well, two things, actually. One is we are sponsored this week by Oakwin Realty. That is our brokerage, best brokerage in town. You know what they did for me this week? I don't know if you've received this yet.
Big surprise.
Oakwin actually, without me knowing, did an audit on my social media, anywhere I am on the internet, to make sure that I was compliant.
Oh yeah, that happened to me too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's incredible. That's incredible. This brokerage is everything they do exceeds my expectations. It's crazy.
Best in the game.
If you're interested in learning more about Oakwin, if you're a new agent, you're just getting your license, you're looking for a change, if you've been in the real estate business for a long time, Oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. There's a big surprise.
Huge surprise.
A huge surprise, just to sit down and talk with these guys, and you will not be disappointed. That is for sure. And the other thing, Adam, is last week we talked briefly about the market coming up, and actually a lot of people have reached out kind of thinking about listing sooner than later,
right?
With questions, right?
We're launching, so I think I've launched – We've launched now 7 or 8 listings, I think, in the last little bit here. And I think we've got a few – well, with a few more coming in the next week or so. Lots of people wanting to have a conversation about what the value of their home is worth.
And I think a lot of this stems from kind of that CMHC. And we talked
right. –
Murtaza's got a lot to say about CMHC's projections that the Canadian real estate is dropping somewhere between 9-18%, and how that changes your plans depending on what your goals are in the next couple of years. But a lot of people after last week's episode have reached out, and we would encourage you to do the same. It's a
for
good
sure.
time to think about goals, potentially reevaluate, potentially not, but
yeah.
But we're definitely around to talk.
Well, we're busy, and it depends what submarket you're in, because you know at the end of the day, there are busy submarkets, sub-price bands. There are softer submarkets, sub-price bands. So really just get in touch, because you might be pleasantly surprised where the value and the demand is for your home in particular. And Matt, it's been fairly busy, all things considered. It feels like lots of movement in the market, at least the markets that we're working in. And
Look at multifamily during May, and the stats haven't come out yet, but we're at week over week, sales are increasing quite dramatically. So
right.
Sun's out. We're positive as per usual. Oh, last thing. We're hiring. We're still hiring.
Yeah, so we have filled the administrative position with someone recently, and we're very excited about that. But we also have positions for licensed agents.
That's right. If you're just getting your license, a new agent, looking to make a change, you want to talk about it, definitely get in touch with Adam and myself. info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com. We're looking for a team member for Scalina Real Estate. Great place to work, no question about it.
For sure.
So get in touch, and maybe we should cut to our talk with Professor Murtaza Haider.
You will not want to miss this conversation with Murtaza. This one is phenomenal.
Enjoy it.
Okay, so we're here with Murtaza Haider, professor at the Ted Rogers School of Management at Ryerson, also the director of consulting firm Regionomics, Inc., and co-author of the Haider-Moranis Bulletin, featured in the Financial Post. How are you doing, Murtaza?
Thank you for asking. Doing well, given the circumstances. I hope you're keeping safe as well.
Yeah, and we should say you. It was a while back, Murtaza, but past guest, fan favorite. Might have been close to 2 years ago, but it's good to have you back.
And Murtaza, can you maybe start? A lot of our listeners will know who you are, but can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yes. So I teach analytics, data science, and real estate at the Ted Rogers School of Management at Ryerson University. My research is basically in two subject matters. One is real estate and the other one is transportation. And the way I try to understand all of this is through the lens of data and analytics.
So we asked you back, Murtaza, largely to get your take on what's going on currently. I guess that's on the top of everyone's mind, COVID-19. We're now basically over 2 months into the COVID-19 shutdown. Is the state of the Canadian economy better or worse than you expected in, say, mid-March?
So the state of the economy is right now in a triage mode. Or not triage, but I would say in a, you know, what goes on in an emergency room of a hospital. It hasn't gone into long-term care. Everything is happening very fast. Every day you realize, oh, we forgot to take care of this, or we forgot to take care of that. So the economy is basically in a stage where the governments are trying to ensure that there's not a significant decline in consumption, which means that people and firms, people and businesses stop buying. If they stop buying stuff, if they stop spending money, then that creates a very big problem. Then the real slowdown in the economy happens. At this moment, the slowdown is because of the restrictions we have imposed on ourselves. So it's not necessarily an economic slowdown. It is a slowdown that is derivative of the movements and barriers that we have ourselves erected that is preventing restaurants from hosting guests and stadiums from inviting people to watch games and so on and so forth. So the economy is in a freeze, not because of economic reasons, but because of healthcare reasons. So 2 months ago, did I expect the? I didn't have much expectations, to be very honest with you. I'll be the first one to admit that I was clueless on the beginning or mid March when all these things happened. Clueless, not in the sense of what was going on, but I had no idea how things will pan out. I had no idea how quickly this disease is going to spread. I also did not fully understand the rate at which it was spreading, the mutations globally. It was a lot of it. We were in the middle of unknown unknowns. Not only that we didn't know a lot of things, but we were also ignorant about our ignorance. We did not know what we needed to know. And in those circumstances, provincial governments, municipal governments, and federal governments in Canada had to plan things. So they were not informed any better than us. And in those circumstances, with limited information, with not much in the past to guide us. I mean, people think it's a SARS-type virus, so we had good experience with it. We had no experience with this kind of challenge in the past. So in those circumstances, governments and businesses and everybody else had to figure out what they're going to do. I think from a positive point of view, with what I think is positive is that I don't see people on the street. I don't see hunger. I don't see people without shelter. And that was a possibility. If you look at the recent estimates from International Labor Organization, they're putting 1.6 billion people across the planet to be whose livelihoods will be threatened. That's the phrase they use, that 1.6 billion people would have their livelihoods threatened. So under those circumstances, I think Canada is doing very good at the moment, in the sense that the governments together, not just the federal government or any particular provincial or municipal government, together, they have been able to come to the rescue. At the end of the day, you know, it sounds odd. At the end of the day, the job of the governments is to ensure that there's consistent flow of money, that there's no decline in spending, because a decline in spending is what a real recession looks like. So to answer, going back to the question you had, that did I expect things much worse or better? Let me confess that I had no grounds to have any expectations, good or bad, at this moment. I didn't have a benchmark. I didn't have these scenarios. In hindsight, 2020, I think many experts will come out and say, as we had forecasted. But I can tell you right now that not a single forecaster came out and said anything about it, because they knew. So people who were wise and smart were aware of their ignorance. Those who were not in the same league were happily forecasting.
Yeah, we're already strategizing about what we are going to say we said back in February.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned what a real recession looks like, Murtaza. You know, you hear people throw around, you know, haven't seen these numbers since the Great Depression, a deep recession, the V-shaped rebound, the L-shape. What do you think, with all the caveats of the uncertain times and crystal balls not having them, what does the rest of this year look like, and maybe into 2021 and even beyond?
Thank you for asking me this. You know, I would rather ask an economist. I'm an engineer, but from an engineer's perspective, because we build things, right? So I think what I'm looking at now is that what people have gotten received in government support, may that be $250 billion plus in Canada, and about a $2+ trillion support package in the United States. All that money is not printed; it's borrowed money, right? The governments had to borrow. So, this is called the sovereign debt, money that the governments have to borrow. So, somebody has to pay that back, right? At the end of the day, like, it's not that it's going to be forgiven. Going forward, now that you know the initial shock has subsided a bit. And I can see people in some parts in Toronto and some parts of Vancouver, you know, the moment they see sun, they are brave enough to run out and put all the restrictions aside. I think, you know, people are getting their feet back, their courage back, and they're getting back to on their feet. So with this, I think the next 6 months will be about how to restart an engine, a large engine. You know, it's like starting sometimes a snowblower. I mean, I'm using it in Vancouver, this example, but let me tell you that at the beginning of the winter, when you have got 2 feet of snow outside your house in Ontario or Quebec, you really are not 100% sure that that snowblower is going to start again, right? Because it has been sitting there in cold in the garage, and then you go with hope, prayer, and some ambition, you try to restart it. Most of the time it does, sometimes it doesn't, right? So that's just a snowblower. Now think of restarting an economy, right? So if you think restarting a snowblower could be challenging at times, I can tell you re-engaging and restarting an economy will have its own challenges. So how do you reopen? How do you phase this in while keeping your eye on the dashboard, telling you the rate at which new cases are being detected, so that you don't overdo it and have a sudden spike in affected individuals. So that is one challenge. How do you do this? Second challenge is the first thing that I mentioned, the sovereign debt. The governments have to start planning as to when they can ramp up the full economy so that money can start going back to governments and taxes. And they start thinking of, how are you going to honor those commitments? At the end of the day, I think the lenders of the last resort, institutions like IMF, would be able to help some governments because there is some ability for them to do that. But I don't think this would be a concern for us in Canada, but it would be a concern for many countries in the global south.
Murtaza, maybe shifting gears to the Canadian real estate market, has anything surprised you about how the market has responded to COVID-19?
Yes, I was surprised at the extent of decline in sales. I was expecting the sales to decline, but not by 70, 80, 90%. And I think the reason being people were very careful and concerned about the well-being of themselves and their children. So the first was the... So a few things happened. People first were not willing to list their homes for open houses. So open houses are gone. And so buying and selling homes unseen becomes a challenge. Now, people asked me in an earlier interview a couple of months ago, do you think people will buy a house unseen? And I said, look, I come from South Asia where people have married spouses unseen. And we continue to do that through arranged marriage. We trust our parents, right? So buying a house unseen doesn't seem that odd to me, at least. But I can see others could be concerned, right? So the thing is, it took some time for people to make that transition from actually buying a house by looking at the videos and whatnot. And in fact, there was an amazing article by a journalist from Toronto Star just this week, where she told the story of how she bought her first condominium in Toronto and how the buyer or someone else did a full WhatsApp tour of the unit while she was somewhere else. And she said, every closet space, every nook and cranny she saw, opened everything remotely. So that transition took some time, and as that transition was happening, people were afraid for two reasons. Number one, that they couldn't see the property. Number two, everybody becomes an economist in times of crisis. So they started thinking that, prices are going to fall significantly. So why do I buy a house now for $800,000? I'm just picking a number. I can wait for 2 months and I can buy it for $600,000. CMHC is forecasting up to an 18% decline in prices, right? This gave a range, 9% to 18%. So, it's almost 20%, let's say. So people say, well, if a 20% decline, that's like saving a lot. So why don't I just wait? So the sellers applied brakes. And the buyers applied brakes. And the sellers started thinking, well, why should I list my home now? Things will get back soon, maybe in the fall or late summer. I'll list my house later. So both of these, the sellers disappeared and the buyers became suspicious of the prices. And that froze the market even further. So yes, was I expecting a decline? Everybody was expecting a decline. But am I surprised at the extent of how big a decline in sales was? Absolutely. I thought people would still be brave. People still have to move. Moving is something that you can, it's very hard to avoid it if you have to move. For example, if you've already sold your unit and your house in which you are and you have to buy a new one, you've already sold the house that you were in. So you have to move, you have to buy. if you have given notice to your landlord that you are moving out, and that notice was given 4 months ago, and now you have to move out, right? So I thought that some moves are unavoidable. Some may be discretionary and could be postponed or scheduled for later. So when I saw those declines, I was, I think 60, 70% on average decline in Ontario, 80% decline in some other parts. That was a surprise. What did not surprise me was the sort of a lack of drop in prices. Prices did drop a little, but if you look at the actually prices for homes that are identical in size and quality, those prices did not drop year over year. So April 2020 and April 2019 prices were not that different when you control for homes for the same size, quality, and location. So, and why I wasn't surprised, because prices are like wages. You know, when you say in recession or 20% of the workforce lost jobs, that is true. But you don't have a 20% decline in people's salaries. You know, those who are working do not get a humongous drop in there. So if there's a 70% drop in sales volume in housing market sales, you won't expect a 70% drop in prices, because prices are like wages and they're sticky. So that was not that much of a surprise. At the same time, I'm also mindful of the fact that if May, June, July, and August continue to be very slow for housing, then yes, declines in prices would become significantly larger.
So you've actually already highlighted the CMHC projection that we're going to ask you next here about the 9 to 18%. Potential drop for the average home price across the country in the next 12 months. Do you agree with that projection, or do you think that there's potential for the CMHC to be right?
So let me put it this way. I know a lot of colleagues in CMHC who do these kinds of research and projections. And I can tell you without a doubt in my mind that they are one of the best real estate economists in the world. These are brilliant people. So if they are saying it, then there must be merit for it. Now, I personally do not expect that steep of a decline in prices over the next 12 months. But then I would say that when you see my opinion different from CMHC, you should also know that there's much bigger knowledge base. They know much more than I do. So there must be things that they know that made them, that compelled them to issue this large drop, forecast for a large drop. I, on the other hand, given my own limited information and acknowledging the fact that what I know is much less than the kind of information that is available to colleagues at CMHC, I, on the other hand, believe that these things, the economy will pick up. And the prices to decline, in order for the prices to decline by that much, you have an abundance of listings that people are, there are sellers available. You know, you bring a product out and nobody's buying it. Then prices drop, right? Because then sellers start to compete against each other for the fewer buyers available. But if buyers disappear, and before the buyers disappear, sellers disappear, then you have a freeze in the market. So the market equilibrium sort of freezes until such point that buyers and sellers return. So it's the same as suddenly a stock exchange halts all trading. Let's say, you know, the trading is happening in New York Stock Exchange, and there's some bad information coming in, so bad that there's been a significant decline, and then at some point, those who manage the exchanges decide, nope, we're shutting it down. When you shut it down, the news is there, the bad news is there. The economic conditions don't change because the stock exchange has shut down. But losses stop because you can't sell or buy. So right now, we have that same analogy to an extent applies to housing markets, that if the sellers disappear and the buyers disappear, then you have the market conditions frozen until such time that the economy starts to come back, and I hope it comes back with a vengeance. And then the buyers return and the sellers return, and the fear of missing out amongst the buyers would mean that they start bidding quickly. So, you know, we waited last time and we missed the 2008 crisis. Let's not do that. There's a lot of kitchen table conversations happened, you know, because in every relationship, I'm assuming people are couples. So in every, there's a, we, couples don't marry very similar people. Like, you know, if the husband is risk prone, the wife ends up being risk averse. If the wife is risk prone, the husband, there's always this dichotomy of views. So the kitchen table conversations become extremely exciting. Where, you know, one of the spouses telling the other one, saying, I told you, because at the same time, hindsight is always 20/20. So I told you, you missed that opportunity. We should have bought that condo in Florida in 2008, or we should have bought that thing in Vancouver Island or whatnot. You know, people do have these conversations. So the fear of missing out becomes a reality in people's minds. And then suddenly, you know, some optimistic columnist in Financial Post writes that things are going to be better. Maybe prices are going to rise faster. And then you say, look, this guy's saying this. He must know something. So you ignore CMHC's warning, which is based on lots of information. And you go with someone who may not have the entire picture. At the end of the day, I think the markets have to resume, because the kind of credit or the kind of borrowing governments have done and to sustain these $2 trillion handout in the U.S. and $250 to $300 billion support packages in Canada, the governments have to put the economic engine back to work at over capacity. Why? Because without those tax revenues coming to them, how would you be able to deal with the sovereign debt that has accumulated? So there will be a vested interest in getting the economy going. And when the economy gets going, people start getting confident. They start buying and selling homes. So the question is, do I expect the prices to fall by 18% in the next 12 months? I don't, but I have the greatest respect for people who think it could happen, because I know they know much more than I do.
So kind of along the same lines, what do you make of the timing of those projections? It strikes me as at a time when there's a lot of uncertainty, and it seems like at least people within the industry are kind of wondering why CMHC seems to be hitting the panic button, you know, and creating kind of a self-fulfilling, or potentially a self-fulfilling prophecy there. What do you make of the timing?
So, you know, I'm an engineer, but I'm envious of economists, because economists 12 months later can say, we are revising our forecasts. Have you ever heard an engineer designing a bridge and then the bridge collapsed and they said, well, we are revising our calculations? So when an engineer revises her calculations or his calculations, he ends up in prison. So the timing is critical, yes. Okay, so what is going to happen now? See, if my memory serves me right, I remember soon after 9/11, President George W. Bush spoke to the nation, and he encouraged people to say, don't be afraid. Don't fall into despair. Go out, have a dinner, go to a restaurant, watch a movie, go to a theater. And people thought, well, what are you grieving, and what kind of advice is this? But that was the right advice. And the advice was to ensure the flow of money through the economy. Because if people sit home, start saving or not spending, then the economic engine starts to collapse. So right now, the governments are in the same mode. They have to incentivize businesses to hire and spend money on R&D and new products and new ventures. And the governments have to encourage people to go out and buy and sell and eat and watch movies whenever the movie theaters are open. Because at the end of the day, you know, Netflix, I mean, it's great. I've watched so much many movies in the last 2 months. But then the fun of being in a theater, right? Like that, right. That smell of popcorn, regardless of how good your microwave popcorn is, it's never the same. It's never buttery, and it never makes your hand you know, soiled with butter coming from that popcorn. That entire feeling of going into a movie theater where someone else has dropped the pop before you, so your feet are sticking to the ground. That's real experience, right? That's the fun of movie going, right? But that's what the economy is, going out spending money. So when you ask CMHC, when I look at CMHC trying to tell people, prices are going to go down, and instead of 5%, you better put 10% down. as a down payment for first-time homebuyers. I don't know how much of this would help with the government's desire to incentivize people to spending and to be to participate in the economy. Again, it's I would never be as bold or foolish to be critical of CMHC, because as I said, there are smart people and they know a lot more. And I'm hoping that over time we will learn what they knew, which we didn't. At times, the governments also have to hold back information. You know, too much information or is good, but not everybody could process it that much. So I'm pleading ignorance on it.
Murtaza, in your opinion, which cities in Canada will outperform the Canadian real estate market? And I guess the flip side of that, which cities will be hit the hardest?
Ah, very interesting question. So the idea of outperforming the Canadian housing market would be to say that your housing sales activity resumes faster, and that the appreciation in prices and the prices start to appreciate over time. It's hard to say. Well, the bottom line is whichever parts of Canada, not the city, because it would be regional or provincial, whichever province is able to get the economic engine restarted sooner, will see the local real estate markets waking up faster from the slumber that they are in currently. So I see great challenges for Alberta. I think we have collectively done injustice to Alberta, and the Albertan housing market is one victim of what has happened there, because we have prevented the province from exploiting the resources it has, resulting in massive slowdown in economy, and that has a direct impact on all markets, including housing markets there. So I see challenges for Alberta continue to be as long as they are unable to exploit the resources that they have. I see challenges in the parts of maritime provinces where there may be a slowdown, but I'm not sure there. I think I think Ontario may lead the recovery. Because I don't expect, I haven't seen much serious damages done to the economy. But the unknown unknowns are still there. Vancouver, when you want Vancouver to outperform, then you have a very sizable segment of the population in Vancouver. I don't know how big or small it is, but it's sizable, that wants the housing markets to further weaken in Vancouver, because they think if housing prices are down, they'll be able to buy it. But I highly doubt it. They will never be as people will not be able to buy housing because prices came down. Once your housing becomes unaffordable, if your financial circumstances don't change significantly, a drop in prices will not enable you to transition from rental to owner, but having an affordable rental market is critical for a just and economic, a just and equitable society. I don't think ownership is tied to it, but people having the right and the ability to have sufficient shelter, which means rental market should be affordable for all, not just for a few. So I think if rents do moderate, that may not be a bad thing, to be very honest with you, because I see a very large segment of Canadians across Canada, in big cities especially, with the exclusion of Quebec. Montreal has very affordable rents traditionally, but especially in Toronto and Vancouver and other parts of British Columbia, a moderation of rents may not be a bad thing. For ensuring that those who are essential to the economy, workers who are essential to the economy, school teachers, police, fire, people who work in the hospitality sector, people who work in the restaurant sectors, they must be and should be able to afford housing as rents, affordable rents, rather than sacrificing other spending. So the question was, who's going to recover faster? I think we should add to the definition of recovery, not just an increase in sales and increase in prices, but we should also add to the definition of recovery an increase in at least rental affordability, so that we can say that not only the city is affordable to me, but it is also affordable to my neighbors, because that's a city you would like to live in, that it's livable for you and your neighbors.
Fair point. Good point. Just a few more questions for you here, Murtaza. We know you're a very busy guy. Just thinking about the biggest challenges moving forward, you know, when CMHC came out with those projections, there was talk about increasing the minimum down payment from 5% to 10%. And my understanding of that is that there's the perception or reality that Canadians are very indebted in a way that is potentially unsustainable and dangerous. I'm curious on your take on that, if that's the biggest challenge facing the Canadian economy moving forward, and what you think about raising the minimum down payment, and if it will happen, I guess.
Well, the decision is with the finance minister. I don't know if anyone else can make that decision, but here's the thing. Our Canadian is a domestic, is the household debt in Canada high? The answer is yes. But at the same time, a comparison with the United States would not be fair, primarily because a lot of what we do here is publicly provided. Like we have public education up to grade 12. We have public health, publicly financed healthcare, single-payer healthcare system. So the kind of economic shocks that people would experience in the United States, if you lose job, you lose healthcare. If you lose job and your kids were in private school, they're out of private school, right? So those kinds of shocks are not prevalent in Canada, which means that people are sort of buffered by the social security nets that we have established. So heavy debt levels are a concern, but not in the same way it would be a concern in the United States. So that's number one. The second thing is, you know, if I were to tell you that, look, you're buying this asset and it may drop in value anywhere between 9 and 18% in the next 12 months, but instead of putting 5% of your money, I would like you to put 10% of your money. That's a puzzle I'm unable to understand, because when the prices go down, it doesn't really matter if you have put in 5% down payment or 10% down payment. Your collective balance sheets are experiencing a loss, right? And if it's you put 10% down, then that's your equity. So that whatever the loss is in the or like decline in value, that's a decline in value in the equity you put in purchasing the house. And if it's 10%, you're going to be taking a bigger loss. So that's one thing. The second thing is a few things happen when you raise barriers to purchasing homes. And so raising the barrier bar from 5 to 10% means that it doesn't mean that people who were able to save 5% would be able to save 10% the same amount of time. They would have to take longer to save that much, because we have just, let's say, you know, 5%. If 5% meant saving $20,000, then 10% means saving $40,000 for the same house. So people would be saving for longer periods, which means that whatever the current status quo is, if they are renters, they will be renters for a longer period. If they are renters for a longer period and that transition from rental to owner is delayed for a large number of first-time home buyers, then it would increase pressure in the rental space, where rents would not moderate even in the case of a pandemic if the number of movers out of rental into ownership is reduced. The second thing, which I said earlier, is that at this, in a case of a pandemic-induced recession, the goal is to circulate funds. The goal is to motivate people to go and spend money. But if you raise the bar from 5% to 10%, asking people to save $20,000 more, that $20,000 is not going to be spent in the economy today, tomorrow, next month, next week, because the household would say, well, I'm going to save this $20,000 because I have to buy the house. I cannot buy it because the minimum down payment has been increased. So that $20,000 will not be circulating in the economy. So that would be against the intention of the governments to induce spending. So that would be actually counteracting the policy. So these are the things. At the same time, you know, if you're a city that is, if you're a person who cannot raise 10%, and you say, well, this is it, $20,000, that's all I can do, I don't have the ability. So they say, okay, well, if I cannot buy this house here, where can I buy something? And often where you can buy is something remote. Like, you know, it's not Vancouver proper. It's probably Surrey or beyond Surrey. So it forces people to move out. So if you're a city or a region trying to fight urban sprawl, then barriers or bars raised for down payments would have an impact, not a large or a small and unknown impact, to be at least at this stage, forcing people to look for affordable units, and that may push them towards lower units, smaller units, because they're cheaper, or units that are farther away. So people may end up buying real estate that does not meet their shelter space needs, or they may end up buying units that have the shelter space that they need, but it's farther away. And they inadvertently, this raising the bar from 5 to 10% may have some contribution in inadvertent, like unexpected or unintended consequence of promoting some sprawl.
You know, maybe just as a final question, Murtaza, you mentioned that you're interested in the role of transportation. Obviously, at least here in Vancouver and presumably, everywhere, all cities with infrastructure, with public transportation, there's been a huge decrease in ridership and a huge challenge with budgeting and things like that. At the same time, it seems like Paris and Vancouver recently, at least, is talking about making some changes as we come out of this, where, you know, moving away from moving away from cars dominating the roads and kind of being more aggressive there. How do you see the role of transportation kind of changing in the next couple of years, kind of related to COVID?
So I think the bigger challenge is what the public transit systems are facing. They are facing drastic shortfalls, and these shortfalls are also tied to the municipal budgets. And so, for example, in Toronto, the Toronto Transit Commission needs $500 million because there's been an 80% to 90% decline in ridership. GO Transit, the regional rail system, has a decline in 90% in ridership. So TTC alone needs $500 million. No, $500 million is not a small amount. The city of Toronto, which is the largest municipality in Canada with 2.7 million people, has a gap of $1.6 billion in its budget. A neighboring municipality, Mississauga, has an 18% hole in its budget. So city of Toronto is 14%, Mississauga is 18%. I think Vancouver's budget deficit is smaller, much smaller in percentage terms, but there are humongous deficits. And then the pressure because of the riders have gone away, and municipalities and transit authorities are still operating transit, even at reduced capacity or lower levels of service, they're incurring huge losses, so much so that the city of Edmonton raised the prospect of actually shutting down the entire transit in summer months until such time that the riders come back. And when the riders will return, you will still have these COVID-19 related restrictions. I don't imagine seeing crowded subway platforms in Toronto in the near future. I don't imagine being packed like sardines again in subways and streetcars soon, maybe in the future, but not probably 2020. Which means that transit carrying capacity, the throughput capacity for public transit, because of the restrictions imposed to keep people safe and social distancing within transit vehicles and on transit infrastructure, that is bus stops, subway stops, platforms, staircases, whatnot, the throughput carrying capacity of these systems will decline significantly, which means that people will be looking for alternatives, and there are two alternatives left. One is car. I think there is going to be an uptake in automobile driving rather than a decline. And the second will be telework, and we are releasing a report today on telework. People think that working from home is one preferred way for governments to consider working from home as a valid mode of transportation, because we have tried over the years spending money. I think in 2016-17, the federal government announced $100 billion in infrastructure spending, of which the bulk, I think $30 billion, was for public transit over a 10-year period, and about $10 billion was for road. That's $40 billion. And you can add another $40 billion from respective provincial governments, maybe another $10 billion from municipal governments, and you get a very large number. And when you spend all this money on building roads and transit systems, 10 years down the road, you interview me and you'll say, well, how come we are still congested, right? There's a gentleman, a professor by the name Anthony Downs, who wrote a book earlier titled Stuck in Traffic. And then 20 years later, he wrote a follow-up to the book saying, still stuck in traffic, right? So I can tell you, you know, when we have this conversation 10 years down the road, we'll be still stuck in traffic. The amount of, because the growing cities have result in the increase in demand for mobility that outpaces the ability for us to build infrastructure that is needed to meet the demand that existed yesterday, let alone that exists today or will exist tomorrow. So that catch-up will never happen. It hasn't happened for any city in the world. Forget about us. We don't have that much transit, but New York does. So does Berlin and London in England and Paris. But they are congested cities as well, no better than us. So people will tell you, urban planners, that you cannot build your way out of congestion if you build more roads. Let me tell you, you cannot build your way out of crowding in transit, even if you build more transit. They all help. They increase the throughput capacity for roads and transit, but congestion will always be there. But there's, I think one thing that government should now seriously think is about telework. When you say, well, these are the modes of transportation, public transit, driving, and then within driving, we have this distinction between auto driver or drive alone and auto passenger, carpooling. And then we have non-motorized modes, bike and walk. Well, let's add telework to it, because right now there's been a significant, dramatic increase in telework, which was around 12% of the people were working from home before COVID-19. And in the end of March and early April, that number jumped to 40% of the people working from home. That could have dramatic impact on people's ability to work without being stuck in roads, in traffic, or packed like sardines and crowded platforms in public transit. So I think for transportation, in addition to public transit, I think one thing, if I have to advise governments, I'd say save public transit now, because if you don't save it now, because their losses are in billions of dollars, when the economy resumes and you're able to relax or suspend these COVID-19 restrictions, then transit should be there to allow people to work and go to work. 70+% of the people who work in downtown Toronto, that's an employment hub of about 450,000 people. 70% of those who arrive for work in downtown Toronto arrive by public transit in the morning rush hours. Right? So you understand how critical it is for these employment hubs to function based on transit. But at the same time, if that's not going to happen, if our throughput capacities on public transit and roads is going to be compromised for a long period of time, then let's add telework to the mix, because that will enable people to be equally productive, at least in the knowledge economy sectors of the economy, and be productive. There was a report done in Toronto, in Ontario, that said, rather complainingly said, that there are 500,000 empty bedrooms in Ontario, and we are overhoused. Actually, I think now with telework, I think those 5 million, I think it's 5 million, those 5 million bedrooms, that's the home office this economy needs to get us going through 2020.
Valid form of transportation. I like that. That's an interesting idea.
So we're going to release a report. I'll share it with you. This report today will show that we have not really woken up to the reality that the advances in information and communication technology, the high-speed internet, the software as a service, cloud computing, big data, video conferencing, teleconferencing, these activities have helped us do remote work. Because how did people were able to get all these software houses shipped to India and China and other parts of the world? Because of this technology. So we have done amazingly well in working remotely, but then remote was not in suburb here. It was in India or China. But now we have to do it for a more localized fashion, where maybe people don't have to go to work every day. Because, you know, a lot of what people do is go to work, sit in an office, open the laptop, connect to the enterprise database systems, and start working. Well, why did you spend 2 hours getting to work to do the same, whereas you could have done the same from your own home? And I'm not suggesting that everybody loves this idea of staying home all the time, especially if you are listening to this podcast and you're in your half a bedroom apartment, and you know, you would think this to be not a pleasant idea. But at the same time, for those who can work from home, those who have space, maybe you should take the opportunity to provide people the ability to work without having the need to commute physically, because technology is not the barrier anymore. I think it's the only barrier is the lack of our imaginations.
Right. Yeah, I like the commute from the living room to the second bedroom too. But that's bad news for podcasters, I think, because a lot of people listen to our show on their commute. But maybe we'll leave it there, Murtaza. But thank you so much for taking the time. And how can people find out more about your writing and what you're up to?
So the best way to find out is to find us, Hader Moranis Bulletin. You just type Hader Moranis Bulletin, and it will take you to the Financial Post and National Post website where our columns are. Or we encourage you to visit urbananalyticsinstitute.com, which is our institute at Ryerson University. So urbananalyticsinstitute.com, where we release our larger studies, one of which will be released soon, on telework and its impact on housing and its impact. Because we are arguing that with telework, if you can work remotely, then you don't have to be competing for expensive housing in the expensive marketplaces. You can actually be a little farther away. So anyway, two places to look for us is Hader Moranis Bulletin on National Post and urbananalyticsinstitute.com at Ryerson University.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much again, Murtaza, for your time. That at least gave me a lot to think about. I'm sure it will give all of our listeners a lot to think about as well.
My pleasure. Great talking to you.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Professor Murtaza Hyder. He's a professor at the Ted Rogers School of Management at Ryerson University.
Yeah, Matt, and also he is the co-author of the Hyder Moranis Bulletin featured in the Financial Post.
That's one that we watch. I mean, if you're looking for updates, intelligent commentary on the Canadian economy and the real estate world, that is a place to go apart from this podcast.
Yeah.
Because they're all updating in the Financial Post on a consistent and regular basis.
For sure. And Matt, I really enjoyed that conversation with Murtaza, and everyone will know why in the intro we said he does such a good job of explaining things.
Snowblower.
Snowblower. Yeah. Movie theater. Made me – I was descriptive. He's so descriptive.
Yeah.
And
I almost started crying.
This has been a very
emotional morning.
Yeah, lots of reminiscing. What else do we got for the day? We've got a couple things. We'll mention one more time that if you are a licensed agent, or if you are looking, maybe you're a seasoned agent, maybe you're somebody who's in the process of getting your real estate license, get in touch. We have positions for licensed agents to join our team, and do that at info@vancouverrealestatepodcast.com. One other thing, Matt, that I wanted to get to, and this actually comes from the conversation we just had with Murtaza, but a lot of people have been speculating that we are going to start to see activity in smaller towns, resort towns, kind of lifestyle-driven areas. Like think of like Squamish. Now that people have the option, and it sounds like a lot of people are going to have the option to work from home more.
Right. A couple days a week, even if you're commuting in 1 or 2 days as opposed to 5. Squamish is looking pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. So will we see – this is a question that we want to pose to the VREP community, but will we see a spike of interest in secondary markets or even lifestyle-driven markets post-COVID? Feel free to get in touch, send us an email or comment on our website.
And you know what? More than commenting on our website, I feel like people comment on our website occasionally, but it's I feel like that's like a 10-year-old way of doing things, right? Like Our Instagram, we're really getting bigger on our Instagram now. That's a place.
Yeah.
That's a place.
Head over Vancouver Real Estate Podcast on Instagram. We're posting more. We were neglecting it. We're posting a ton now, and if we're also posting some questions, because we really, like, the big thing is we want ideas for show topics. We want to hear what you're seeing and feeling on the ground. Maybe you're buying. Maybe you're thinking of selling. What are your concerns? Join us on Instagram. There's a conversation going on over there.
Yeah, definitely join us on Instagram. You can also head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. That is our website where we have the live wire. That's our weekly mailer. We're posting stats before anyone else, and stats that not everyone else is seeing, that's for sure. So you'll want to sign up to the live wire over there. We also have our research tool, Private Client Services.
And Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information at your fingertips. It's free. It's the best way to look for real estate in Vancouver. And it's available on our website, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And if the CMHC is getting you spooked, get in touch anytime, 778-847-2854 or Matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or if you're not scared at all, try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And if you're super excited to not have to come into work anymore.
Yeah, or just super terrified in general.
You can get in touch with Secret at info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Just trembling in a bunker somewhere.
All right, enjoy the sun, guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Take care.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.